This is How Success Happens, where we talk to polar explorers, war correspondents, founders, ultramarathoners, authors, artists, and a range of other unique personalities to help you understand the capabilities behind how success happens.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
When I'm training for an ultramarathon, anywhere from 100 to 120 miles a week would be in my training cycle. Lots of miles.
You sold something like 250,000 books.
I'm the managing editor at entrepreneur.com and your host, Linda Lissina. Today, we'll talk to Matt Joswiak. Hi, Matt. How are you?
Hi, Linda.
He's a chef by trade who founded Rethink Food, a just-launched nonprofit that takes food that would otherwise be thrown away and transforms it into meals that can be distributed to hungry people. At its heart, it's a simple enough idea. He certainly didn't invent feeding hungry people, but his execution could help struggling restaurants and potentially create an entirely new business sector. He'll explain all of this, as well as why he's been spending hours wrangling with the FDA and IRS, and what he's learned about listening to other people. He'll also share how he's transitioned from a side hustle to a nonprofit, and what any entrepreneur can keep in mind. Hi, Matt. How are you?
Hi, Linda. Just fine.
Very good. All right. So why don't you sort of catch everybody up and tell us a little bit about your background leading into Rethink Food.
So I'm a chef by trade. I worked in, many great restaurants in Copenhagen, France, and obviously in the States. And I came to New York about 3 years ago to work with a startup nonprofit that just put chefs in places where they were trying to help, the community succeed. And that's essentially where I noticed the first disconnect between the nonprofit sector, the for-profit sector, chefs, and the community. They're all very disjointed, but they're all after the same goals.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so how does that sort of get us into Rethink Food? Tell us exactly what Rethink Food does and the sort of the life cycle that you've had so far, right? Because it's very much in the early stages.
Yeah. So Rethink Food actually started about a year ago.
Yes.
We started as something for nothing. And
yes.
Then we thought the best idea was to go into schools and teach kids how to cook healthy meals. That was the initial thing. So when I started working with the New York Academy of Medicine, doing workshops and, talking to other nonprofits about what was needed in the community, we realized that there was no shortage of people wanting to teach kids how to cook healthy. There was a shortage of product. There was a shortage of food. So from working in fine dining restaurants and, doing private parties and private homes for, extremely wealthy people, I noticed that there is a large amount of food that's just totally discarded without any type of documentation.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, here's the food here. How do I get it there?
Yeah.
And that's what Rethink Food does. We take extra good food that just currently does not have a place.
Yeah.
We collect it. We process it, meaning that we pasteurize it and then freeze it into meals.
Mm-hmm.
And then we redistribute to those who need. It's a very, very simple thing.
Yeah, yeah. No, I love it. And you recently sort of had a breaking point, right, between sort of being a side hustle to like sort of doing Rethink Food full time. Tell us a little bit about that, right? Because you just, until a few weeks ago, were still sort of doing private parties, working as a chef, right? But tell us about what a breaking point means for a chef who's already working a million long hours.
It's the, the 115-hour week. That was it. And it's, I think you when you start making mistakes and missing emails and missing calls, even though you're a chef, sometimes you work 7 days a week, sometimes you work 16 hours a day. You know, it's just part of the deal. We all knew it when we signed up.
Yeah.
It's what funds my organization.
Sure.
But at the same time, when it starts to hurt your organization, then the side hustle has to transition.
Mm-hmm.
Into it. And I think you know when it's time to transition, because if your organization has grown to a point where it can get hurt by missing an email, then it's time to focus,
Yeah, yeah. It's an important note there. And so let's talk about this whole food equation, right? So there's this issue of food waste with restaurants, with preparing for a private party, things like that. I don't know that a lot of people listening to this really understand what that means, right? Can you sort of explain to us what happens, with what the food that's left over? What is it like? These are prime ingredients. What is happening with this stuff that could go to hungry people?
Well, it's pretty simple. You know, we, you know, especially as New York City diners, we are accustomed to a certain level and a certain quality.
Yeah.
And nothing's more frustrating than going to a restaurant and trying to order something and they don't have it, you know? And what restaurants have to do is they have to prepare for 200 people to walk in the door. But sometimes, you know, to keep that level of quality. And sometimes 200 people will walk in the door.
Yeah.
But more often than not, it'll be 140, 150, whatever the capacity of that restaurant is.
Yeah.
So every night, at the end of the night, all of those dishes, all those elements, fresh pasta, you know, minestrone broth, you know, beautifully cooked beans, all these things are just discarded.
Yeah.
Because it's not the fault of the restaurant, because they have to keep this level of quality. It's so important, mm-hmm. especially in a marketplace as competitive as fine dining restaurants. They must keep this level of quality, and you can't serve three-day-old lemon juice in a cocktail for, you know, $18. It's just impossible.
Yeah.
So they just haven't had a space for it yet, you know, and that's essentially what we're here to do.
Yeah, that's really, really interesting. And so give us some examples of ingredients from maybe even your pilot program where you were repackaging those ingredients for some a new meal for someone.
So our pilot program, our first one was really, really amazing. And I was terrified going into it because I wasn't exactly sure what they were going to give us. And through the meetings that we had before with the restaurant, they weren't sure what they were be able to give us.
Yeah.
And I knew that it was either going to be, you know, a couple of little things or a truck full of stuff. Yeah. And it was, they gave us a fourth of what they had.
Wow.
And what we were able to do is create one kind of like a seafood soup that was really delicious. And then the second thing we were able to create was a minestrone soup that was fantastic. And then we realized that we also are able to create beverages because, you know, New York City's cocktail scene is very up and coming. Not up and coming, been crushing it for several years. And, you know, they have to use fresh juices every single night. They have to use fresh juice. So we were able to create low sugar, we called it an electrolyte drink that had cucumber, lemon, lime. There was even like a little watermelon juice in there that was like bright and fresh and refreshing. And, you know, we were able to freeze that and distribute it to the food bank in New York City as well. So there's a lot of, in meal creation, there's a lot of ability. I mean, it kind of actually lends itself to you, you know. It's actually quite easy.
Sure, sure. Yeah. Well, and I think what people don't understand, too, is that they think about meals that are given to food banks and things, and they don't understand that the food banks need to have an ability to distribute the meals, right?
Right.
There's this gap, I think, in what people expect or imagine food banks are actually doing, right? Can you talk a little bit about how important it is to sort of have something that is ready for them to distribute?
Yeah, so that was a huge part of our growth, and that was a very important conversation. That honestly, like you said, I didn't realize what that was like, and I definitely understated it. And I met with Lee from the Food Bank of New York City, and she explained to me kind of what she wanted and what she needed. And there was, you know, there's things that go as far as, you know, in community housing. Yeah. What's the size of the refrigerator? What does that look like? You know, what's the best, you know, width and length of a bag full of, you know, a great meal? You know, how do we fit that in there? And how do we fit 12 of them in there?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So something that Rethink does, and I think does very well, is we listen. We listen to absolutely everybody. We're not here to reinvent the wheel. We're here to strengthen the wheel.
Yeah.
So essentially what we're working towards is a better distribution system for the food bank. Not only just processing their stuff for them,
sure,
but helping them deliver better meals faster and easier.
Yeah. No, I love that. And I think it's also really interesting because in part of your what Rethink Food does is create training opportunities for new chefs. Can you talk a little bit about that and sort of the opportunity that could down the line be available from that?
So we're a firm believer that food's changing. You know, food's changing. There's a lot of really kind of crazy stuff going out there. I mean, we see Blue Apron.
Yeah.
And Blue Apron 5 years ago, you know, nobody really knew what was going on or what it was, maybe a select few. But the way that we consume food is inherently changing and how we buy it and how we order it and seamless and everything. You know, and there's even, you know, such interesting programs like in, you know, Santa Barbara. There's a program, you know, called the Semi-Private Chef where you actually just call the chef, you interact with him, and then he creates kind of a meal that for you whenever you want. and he's available 6 days a week. And this, it's a new frontier.
Yeah.
So that's why we want to train people. We want to bring people in. We want to show them that this isn't garbage, because
it
absolutely 100% is not. But this is how you utilize this food. This is how you distribute it. And once we have, you know, unskilled laborers, we don't want chefs with experience. We want nothing like that. We want people from the East Harlem Alliance, people who need the jobs, to give them good jobs and then help them in this new space to kind of create this industry. I mean, create a new industry.
And
to do that, you got to train.
Sure. You know? Yeah. And what's the opportunity in that new industry, right? Because it's beyond just giving people jobs, right? What is the real sort of opportunity that you see with that sector?
I mean, it can go so far. I mean, every single industry that we've looked at, you know, one I had a long conversation with a pretty large construction company. And I was talking to them about their waste, you know, because I'm always looking at other ideas for how these things work. There's an entire industry for excess materials in construction.
Yeah.
There's entire industries for every other industry. There's a sub-industry for what goes on with that extra stuff. It's everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, we as chefs, we don't have that.
Yeah.
So what we're trying to do is build that space, build those people, and give them the skills to kind of understand that. And it's going to take a long time. It's going to take a very, very long time. But if we get people thinking in that direction, to kind of rethink food, if you will, you know, we can do it. We can hopefully do it, you know, fully in my lifetime. And that's my goal. You know?
Sure, sure. And there's also maybe an opportunity to take the pressure off of a nonprofit to fund it simply by calling, you know, doing phone banks and calling people. Can you tell people a little bit about that opportunity?
Absolutely. So a lot of what we took was Goodwill's model, you know, and what we do is, you know, not in the initial 2 years, but after the 2 year mark, we're going to kind of shoot for a two prong effect. I don't think people realize that there are very, you know, there are huge food deserts in New York. And for those who don't understand what a food desert is, it's where you can't get fresh produce or, you know, low sugar, you know, meals of any kind, where basically you shop out of bodegas.
Yeah.
And not to downplay the bodega, they have feed more people than I think I'll ever be able to.
Of course.
And great parts of the community. And what we want to do is since we have no cost for our product, our product is excess and allegedly nobody wants it. So we want to distribute better products into the bodegas so that people can get the, you know, EBT can last longer.
Mm-hmm.
They can feed their families with better, you know, more nutritious food.
Yeah.
And we can really hit it from both ends because people don't like taking free food.
Yeah.
Unless you really, really, really need it, it's not fun.
Yeah.
You know, and we don't want, you know, we want to be there to support that side of it, but we also want to be able to help communities grow. And by, you know, if you could imagine you could get enough food, if we could hit the price point of McDonald's and put it in a bodega, it would change a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And so down the line, that might be a source of revenue that would further help your efforts to feed even more people, process more excess food, and kind of go on and on and on.
Correct. We think that, you know, based on our model, we think about 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
It'll take for us to be completely self-sufficient.
Yeah, yeah.
And if we hit that, you know, zero mark, then we're, the sky's the limit.
Yeah.
You know, then we could do this everywhere.
Yeah.
And we will. I mean, there's no way that you can collect. It was actually odd because we actually had a situation, since I didn't have a processing kitchen, we had a case of king crab that was worth like $360 donated, right? I wasn't able to process it because I didn't have the kitchen, and I can't donate that because of the shellfish allergies and all that kind of stuff. So we were able to redistribute it to somebody who was doing a charity fundraiser, and we got the money as a donation, which helps further our thing. So it's all about getting this food into places that's going to be helping people and helping the community. And we'll, you know, we start there.
Yeah, yeah. There's a surprising aspect of all this that I think a lot of people don't would not have considered, right? Which is some of the fine print, right? So one part of this is the FDA, right? What did you have to do with the FDA, and why is that so important in sort of untangling so that more donations can happen?
You know, it was a lot of. It was just a lot of very, very long conversations about pasteurization. Because what we're really trying to do is beat this idea about foodborne illness, which is a you know, most organizations call it the foodborne illness boogeyman.
Yeah.
It's not a real thing. It's just a misconception. Yes, if you leave tomato soup out for 7 hours, we're not going to take that. That's garbage.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But if you have extra food in some capacity, like we're more than happy, 200 pounds of frozen chicken backs is not garbage.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So we're trying to beat this and, you know, we took a lot of steps. So essentially we had our, you know, we have a pretty extensive legal team. You know, Jeff Brotman, you know, is a very wise lawyer in the field of tax law. He actually teaches tax law. Yeah. At a law school to lawyers, and he's a CPA. We have Dominique Day, who, you know, Stanford law grad, and my sister, who helps me. You know, she created a liability agreement so that we were able to say, look, if we take this food out of your restaurant and there's a banana in it and the banana hits and somebody walks down the sidewalk and falls down, and we will take on that liability. We take on any liability whatsoever. As soon as that food touches us, anything. And that's a huge part of what we do. So we're taking the fear out of sharing because it is. That's our biggest challenge is breaking that conception that this is trash.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So that's what the outside world thinks. The restaurant knows it's delicious, good food. Yeah. You know, me personally, as a chef, I've been eating it for years.
Yeah. Love,
you know, the stuff from the end of service. And we have to convince the restaurants that this is it. So that's why you have a very lengthy legal agreement that under any situation, you're fine.
Yeah, yeah. Did it surprise you that so many lawyers would be involved in basically a food donation startup?
No. Because I worked on the chef side and I knew the fear and I've heard the excuse 100 times and I've heard it in 3 countries and, you know, 2 U.S. major cities. So I know that it's a very real phenomenon that this exists. So that was one of the first things I did was lawyer up because I needed all of that power to get people to convince us. And I'm very grateful for the work that they've done, and they've done fantastic work so far. So
yeah. And it's important, I think, for people to understand why this sort of simple idea hadn't gotten more traction, right? It is because of this fear that folks felt that they were going to be sued by trying to do something that was nice, right?
Exactly. And it's very understandable. I mean, there's a lot of liabilities that go into running a restaurant. There's a lot of, you know, time and effort. And like I said, the restaurants aren't doing exactly well right now. It's a very hard time for restaurants. So the idea of at the end of a 14-hour, 16-hour shift to be packing up food and processing it again and distributing it is fair.
Yeah.
You know, one very interesting case I just ran into is this guy owns an apple orchard.
Yeah.
And he has like literally tons of apples that he tried to bring to a homeless shelter in the area.
Yeah.
And they turned him away. He threw out like a truckload of apples. He just took it to the dump.
Yeah.
So it's also on the side of the food pantries and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we also take it away from it. We take on all liability in any way, shape, or form. And that's why these conversations with the FDA are so important.
Yeah.
And not to say that, you know, God forbid anything ever did go wrong, that we would point the finger at the FDA. But I mean, essentially, we're gonna follow their rules. They know exactly what's going on. And we don't wanna be like, oh, checked in by the FDA or the Department of Health. We wanna work side by side.
Of course.
We wanna solve this thing together, mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, no doubt. And there's another aspect of law that I think is really, really interesting. And it comes down to sort of the tax situation and how you can help the restaurants who are donating, right? This is a key piece of this that can help restaurants who are a low-margin business. Can you talk a little bit about that and how important that is?
Absolutely. Jeff Broughton, the attorney that I mentioned earlier, you know, kind of helped me out a lot with this idea. So we, you know, like I said, back to the goodwill model, you know, and it's about, you know, the value of food. And this took about a solid 8 months. You know, we kept going back and forth about do we take each individual thing and try to approximate its value or suggest a value. But what we came down to is how many meals do we get out of your donation?
Mm-hmm.
And what do you feel a meal from your restaurant's worth? So we will say, like, you know, Restaurant X gave us enough to generate 60 meals. They felt it was worth $10 each, you know, that which is totally fair. You know, that's $600 of an in-kind donation. Now, that's a very, very small donation. So if you're talking about a restaurant, they could feasibly make, you know, reduce their tax bill by, you know, $100,000, $150,000 of their taxable income by the end of the year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it would not be that hard, you know, because we can really generate and push, you know, generate those numbers. I mean, they're there. They're there. It's amazing what a small donation and how far it will go.
Sure. Yeah, and have a real incentive for them to keep coming back and calling you.
Exactly, exactly. And that's how it has to work. Yeah. You know, you have to have restaurants. You have to push things. Nobody, you know, as much as we all want to sit around and like volunteer every minute of our time to help people and yeah. do the right thing, people need to fight for, yeah. they need to worry about their business and their livelihood and stuff like that. And we have to inspire them to do so. We have to inspire every individual group to do the right thing. And with this, we hope and we think the restaurants will be giving us everything they got by the end of the next tax year once they see what they can get out of it. You know, it's a new idea. You know, we'll see how it goes.
Yeah. And so with all this, waste is all around us, as we all know. As you mentioned before, that most industries already sort of have a way to kind of, you know, have a sub-industry that deals with waste. But just on a personal level, we all cook, we all clean out our refrigerator, we all wonder, why on earth didn't I eat X or Y out of the thing, you know? But there's still a surprise, I think, to most people that that there would be this much waste anywhere. You know, even though that personally they know they go to a restaurant and they don't eat half of what they ordered. Maybe they take it and put it in a to-go bag and maybe they forget to eat it or maybe they don't or whatever. Why do you think that this idea of waste is still such a surprise?
You know, I just think that people don't like to hear about problems that they don't have solutions to. Like with the hurricane relief effort, you know, you see it and it's sad. And then directly after there's a way that you can donate or something that you can do to help. So it's okay. And then people talk about it, but we've all just been sitting around scratching our heads at this idea for a long time and trying to figure out a solution. And that's why I think people don't want to talk about it. We all know, you know, it's not shocking at all. I mean, it's New York City's biggest organic waste trumps every other type of waste that comes out of New York City. By a long shot. It's 1.3 million tons of organic waste. And that's food, yard waste, which is very little in New York City.
Yeah, of course.
And also, you know, paper material, napkins and such. Yeah. That's New York City's biggest excess. That's the biggest waste. And it's just about dividing that. I'm not saying I'm going to take all of that. Yeah. But if we took a 1% that must be good, it would solve the issue that one in three kids in the Bronx is hungry,
which is
crazy. And it's the first page of our deck. The first page of our deck is the amount of children that live in, you know, insecure, food insecure homes in the Bronx, which is one in three, which is a shocking number, to how much is actually being wasted in New York City. These things just don't make sense. They just don't line up. And that's essentially what we do. We just move the food.
Well, and I think it's an important point that you make, right? So one in three children in the Bronx, one in four children in New York altogether is food insecure. And so when we talk about food insecurity, we're talking about like anything from like going hungry to skipping meals. You know what I mean? These are children, right? Added to this are people who are working people,
correct.
People who are parents who have jobs, who maybe aren't taking a meal because they want their kid to eat, or even, elderly people who can't eat for various reasons, right? Maybe they don't have the funds, maybe they can't get out, maybe they can't cook, it's not safe, right? All of these things exist. If we all spent 5 minutes thinking about this, we would all think of those scenarios. But again, like, why does the idea of a hungry person, why does somehow an image of a lazy person who doesn't want to, like, pull themselves up by their bootstraps come up, right? what's the disconnect? Like, I don't get it.
I don't get that either. And I think this is just, when I was teaching classes in the Bronx, you know, I was teaching to 7th graders. There was a class of 15, six had never seen a salad.
Yep.
You just don't live there. You don't see it. And you don't understand like what it's like. It's very hard to pull yourself up by the bootstraps when A, you can't afford the boots and B, you're starving, you know? So it's a very sad thing. And the biggest thing to note is all these numbers, they're going up. They're not going down. Yeah. They're going up. And by a lot, seniors are getting hit the worst.
Yeah.
Seniors are currently getting hit the worst. And every year they become more and more hungry. And it's just really messed up.
And so let's talk a little bit about in running Rethink Food, right? What sort of capabilities are like you depending on most, you personally? Like what is helping you sort of keep this engine going?
An ability to be humble is a really big thing. Ability to listen to any idea from anybody has been really huge. I think it's that I really value people. I truly value everybody's input.
Yeah.
If you give me 5 minutes of your time, I will really listen to everything you say. And then the next time I write the Rethink Food update, I'll mention that 5 minutes and I'll mention what I learned in that 5 minutes.
Yeah.
I think that's why we've been our ability has gone so fast. I'm not, you know, I didn't go to college. I'm a chef by trade.
Sure, sure.
And so I really appreciate every little thing that's been given to us, and I think that's really what pushes us forward. And like personal traits, endurance, you know, that's what I'm good at. I'm good at just driving things home and work until they're done, you know, and that's a chef quality.
Of course.
You know what I mean? And I think that's what's really in tandem with getting the feedback from the people that we have with a solid work ethic. I mean, Wisconsin style, you know?
Midwest.
That's right.
Midwest. Well, but I think it's interesting, too, because you and I chatted before, and you're like, look, there's no new ideas here.
Yeah.
There's no new ideas here, right? Yeah. If somebody has a good idea, I'll use it. Tell me about that idea, that ability to just be like, I don't know, that's great, I'm going to do that. That's awesome, thank you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know, it was, we became successful because we listened to people. We listened to what organizations have. Like I said in the beginning, we're not reinventing the food system. You know, we're just fixing a little. We're just tweaking it a little bit.
Yeah. You also mentioned, so as a chef, you constantly have to have a contingency plan. You know, what? Tell me, when you're cooking, when you're in the kitchen, what does a contingency plan look like? Like, what does that mean?
You know, it's like, you know, the steak thing, you know, it's like you're cooking steak and you have like, you know, you're working a meat station, you know, and you have so many things going on. And if somebody wants their steak medium rare, you know, and you send it out and they think, oh, well, this is a little too rare for me. You always have to have that backup steak.
Yeah.
Cause you can't wait 30 minutes, let it rest, all this stuff. You can't wait that long.
Yeah.
So what we always try to do is always try to make sure that we act in some level of duality with a tandem plan. You know, from everything from our launch party to the food for our launch party, for, you know, using Eventbrite or Stripe or PayPal or whatever thing that we're going to use to take donations, we always try to work out some backup thing to make sure that if the moment, you know, if the hatchet does fall, we can go somewhere else. We can handle something else.
Yeah. You know? And what's an example of how you guys have needed to put a contingency plan into place?
A big thing was, you know, the first place restaurant we used the excess food from was the Nomad. And we reached out to, you know, maybe 15, 20 restaurants through their About Us page.
Yeah.
And I was thinking we'd get 5 out of that. But what we realized is that nobody reads those emails. Those emails essentially just go to nowhere.
Yep.
We got emails about a month after,
of course,
saying that they would be interested, but none with enough response time. So the entire time I was just like, okay, I know Will Gadara, and he's been wildly supportive and very much so a mentor to me. And I reached out to him, and I really hate asking him for favors because he already has done so much for me. I don't want to,
of course,
you know, use too much of his time. And I reached out and I said, Will, like, would it be any way possible, like, this would mean a lot, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, 5 minutes later, I get this email and we launch right into it. It's not, you want to sell the first steak.
Of course.
But, you know, sometimes you got to use that other one, you know.
Use the backup steak.
Use the backup steak.
Yeah. I think the idea, too, that you have about sort of being open to any idea regardless of whether it was your idea or someone else's, even like sort of borrowing elements of Goodwill's model for yours, for your nonprofit, I think is really, really interesting. And I think that it speaks a little bit to me about how innovation actually happens. Innovation isn't about some sort of great leap. We didn't get the rocket right away.
Yeah.
We didn't get any of that, you know. Tell me a little bit about like how that sort of helps you guys move forward a little bit more quickly.
Well, I'm glad you said this, because this is everybody always says, oh, you know, you're a chef, you're going to be creative. I don't really feel that cooking is intuitively creative.
Yeah.
Food is a necessary thing, you know, and like you're talking about, innovation comes out of, you know, having your back against the wall.
Yep.
You know, those are the situations that make you think of new ideas. And that's essentially the position that we're kind of like, not with our backs against the wall, but we need to solve this problem. Mm-hmm. So how do we do it in the ways that make sense in the environment? And that's where this kind of, you know, intuitive, creative, I mean, I don't like to call it creative. I like to say we're crafting an idea. You know, we're making something that's solid and longevity. Creativity always seems a little flimsy, you know. So I want to make it like, you know, what we're trying to do is utilize the issues and the situation to make ourselves successful.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think also creativity is almost a charged word where people feel like if you say be creative about something that somehow they have to go somehow draw a starburst or a unicorn somewhere.
Yeah, exactly.
And they we're very good because we were trained to be creative when we were, I just did air quotes, anyone listening can see my air quotes, but I just made air quotes. We were trained to be creative when we were little children, and we don't know what creative means when we're working. We don't know what that means.
Right.
So does that help you guys, be creative without being creative, find solutions to things in an easier way?
Yeah, I think that, like, creative environments are without judgment. Yeah. I think that's a big thing to say. And that's very much so the environment that I've worked to cultivate, which I think has led us to progress very quickly, is that when you have people, you know, that have kind of crazy ideas about how to do things or why don't you try this or, you know, I remember... You know, we hired a cook to help us process all the food, a really great guy, Aaron. And he was in the van, and we were driving the van to the kitchen in the middle of the night through New York City. And he says, no more night pickups. Yeah. You know, no more night picks up. Doesn't make sense. No, I mean, he wasn't fully involved in the company yet. He just come on help board. And, you know, we looked at that and we said, yeah. And then we realized that if we go on this path of finding like, okay, well, like, why don't we just act like a vendor? Like the vendors come into the restaurants very early in the morning. That's when the guys are there. That's when it's the most calm, you know. And then we completely changed our system so that at the end of the night, the closing chef will write all the things that are going to be donated and then, you know, put them on the side of the fridge. And then they'll tell us what containers I have to bring. Mm-hmm. They'll text us how many containers we have to bring. And then it just simplifies the entire process.
There's been a lot of interest in startup culture and founders and creating, which is awesome because I think more people are thinking about problems that they can solve more than any time maybe in recent memory that I have. But I think one of the problems is a lot of the stories that get the widest reach and the biggest visibility are on celebrating the wrong type of activity, right? Hustling for the sake of hustling, not necessarily hustling to sort of move or solve a problem and not growing, but sort of, you know, I'm the icon. I'm going to tell you because I'm the creative genius, right? And It's all going to go from genius as opposed to that sort of thing where you said, like, you know, the collective will have the mind, right? And so I think that there's maybe also, what are your thoughts on that? That, like, maybe there's also a power in seeing different types of problem solving.
Yeah, I everything that I try to do is simply from experience, you know, yeah. And. Like when I started in New York, I said I worked for an organization, and it was very much so that.
Yeah.
You know, the founder was, I'm the boss, and this is how it is. And we moved so slowly.
Yeah.
And when I started this, it's like my timeline is too far ahead. It's almost uncomfortably too far ahead.
Yeah.
Because of just using this model and listening to people. I think it's very dangerous. I think pride is very dangerous. I think ego is very, very dangerous. I think it destroys good ideas. I think it destroys initiatives. And not to say that I've never been, you know, egotistical, you know,
at any point. No, of course not.
My life, but, you know, or that I'm, you know, some perfect person. But, like, you know, I'm very, very, you know, I think that's my biggest fear is becoming this, like, I'm the boss or look at me or, you know, this thing. I mean, I even had some... You know, I never want to be the guy on the front of the magazine, ever. I don't care what we have to do, you know, within the range of the law to get food to these people. I don't care. I really don't care. You know, if you want me to do a song and dance on TV, raise enough money to get people this food that's readily available, you know, I don't care what it has to do. It has nothing to do with me.
I think some of the rigidity that comes from some founders simply comes from fear, right? It comes from like, I've invested everything into this thing and it needs to work. And yeah. and some of it just comes from wanting to control. Somebody who needs to release a little bit of control. Do you have any advice for that person who's struggling with that? What can they do? How can they be more like Matt?
Calm down, it'll be fine. I mean, that solely comes from being a chef. When you're so buried and you have this list that you know takes 5 hours and somehow you only have 45 minutes to do it. And at the end of the day, everybody's eating, everything's fine, everything's okay, the world didn't explode. I say that to, you know, when I did manage in a kitchen, I said that to cooks all the time. I'm like, you've been cooking for 5-6 years. How many times has the restaurant exploded because you ran out of pasta?
Yeah.
Did you ever run out of pasta? No. It's always happened. It will always happen.
Of course.
But if you don't handle those peak moments of stress appropriately, it won't. That's what will destroy you.
Yeah.
That's absolutely what will destroy you. And it's the same thing when you're like a line cook. When you start spinning, as Chris Flint would always say, you start spinning, go around, that's when you're going to fail. When you stop, you take a deep breath, you look at the situation, and you plan, decision-making, then you're it's going to be fine.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. Thanks, Matt, for all your insights. And to listen to more podcasts from this series, find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and follow us on SoundCloud.